All right, thanks. Why doesn't everybody have a seat? So this case is Ramona Martinez and the Stevens Law Offices versus the Vinitz Law Firm and others. May I have any of your opinions, please?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Jay Eisenstein on behalf of the petitioners.
Mr. Eisenstein. Counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Robin Scully on behalf of respondents in this law firm and Eric Krajewski.
All right, very good. Counsel, this case has been set for 1 hour. That means that each has a half an hour. Mr. Eisenstein, you'll have to keep track of your own time. It's easy enough to do. There's a marker there on the podium. And if you wish to reserve some time, just watch your numbers and save it yourself. Go ahead, please, whenever you're ready. Oh, and I forgot to say, I guess you're wondering what half the court is. Justice Marquez and Justice Hood are both not participating in this case.
May it please the court. This case is about two things: the court's authority to regulate unreasonable contingency fee agreements and protecting the inherent rights of clients to choose their own counsel. As a background, this case stems from the death of a young lady and the subsequent representation of her mother by two separate law firms. The petitioner, Ramona Martinez, retained the Mintz Law Firm to represent her in relation to the wrongful death of her daughter, April. The Mintz Law Firm was retained under a contingent fee agreement, and their representation lasted approximately 11 months. At some point during that representation, they did receive an offer of settlement in the amount of $100,000. However, that offer was rejected via counteroffer.
Via what? I didn't hear that.
By a counteroffer.
Oh, counteroffer.
Ms. Martinez terminated the Mintz Law Firm prior to the occurrence of the contingency. She then retained the Stevens Law Offices, again under a contingent fee agreement, and the Stevens Law Offices proceeded to represent her during the litigation of the matter. At the outset of litigation, the Mintz Law Firm filed an attorney's charging lien under CRS 12-5-119. This was just after the complaint was filed on the matter, and the lien amount was $33,333.33. That amount was determined by applying the one-third contingency fee to the rejected $100,000 offer. Again, at the time Ms. Charges lien was filed, the case was still in litigation and the contingency had not occurred. At the time of filing the complaint, there was no offer on the table, and the case's value was effectively zero. The Stevens Law Firm litigated the case over the next year and ended up settling it approximately a year later for $110,000. Stevens Law Firm then placed the contractually agreed amount of 40% contingency fee in trust and distributed the remainder minus cost, 60% minus cost, to the client, Mrs. Ramona Martinez. Stevens then filed a motion in the district court that heard the underlying matter to void the Mintz Law Firm's charging lien. Mintz responded with a motion to compel arbitration against Ms. Martinez for their fees pursuant to an arbitration agreement, an arbitration clause in their contingent fee agreement. The district court denied that motion on the basis that Mintz purported to hold validly enforceable against third parties, that Stevens Law Offices was a junior lien holder against those same funds, that the client could only be responsible for paying one contingency fee, and that there was no arbitration agreement between the Stevens Law Offices and the Mintz Law Firm. In other words, Ms. Martinez had already paid the highest contingency fee to which she had agreed under either contingency fee contract, and this dispute was now between the law firms. Ms. Martinez no longer had a dog in this hunt. The district court then held an evidentiary hearing on the motion to void Mintz's attorney and found that the $33,333 that they were claiming under the charging lien statute was frivolous, and that at most, the Mintz Law Firm was entitled to $1,000 for the approximate 10 hours of work that they performed on the case. Judge Enquist at the district court found that none of the $110,000 recovery was contributed to by the Mintz Law Firm. That finding is the same as Mintz's purported fee being excessive and unreasonable. In Bear v. Springer and Steinberg, an appellate court interpreted A similar district court conclusion that the contingency fee was unreasonable and excessive as a determination that the contingency agreement was unenforceable under Colorado Rules of Procedure, Chapter 23.3, Rule 6.
That's the first agreement? Not the second agreement, the first agreement?
That's the first.
Two separate agreements?
Yes, Justice. That's the first contingency fee agreement between Mrs. Martinez and the Ms. Long.
And no recovery at all for the Ms. Long?
The facts state that there may have been some recovery, slight windfall due to a medical payments coverage that they received. The Ms. Long represented April Martinez prior to her death and was able to recover $5,000 in medical payments prior to her passing. When she died, Mrs. Martinez hired them and the case converted to a wrongful death case. This matter is not really concerned with April's matter, but there was some amount of money that went to this law firm. It's not clear from the record exactly how much. Judge Inquis also awarded fees and costs to the Stephen Law offices for the frivolous and groundless nature that she determined was in relation to that charging. The Ms. Law firm appealed the district court's ruling, and the court of appeals reversed, determining that the district court should have compelled the matter to arbitration, even if the arbitrator would have come to the same conclusions. However, by doing so, the appellate court implicitly ruled that Ms. Martinez may have to pay more than the 40% contingency fee, which she had agreed to under both fee agreements. The appellate court erred because it treated this contingent fee agreement like a normal business contract. It erred by failing to consider the special fiduciary nature of attorney-client contracts and the special fiduciary nature of that relationship. This court granted certiorari on three issues, the first of which is whether a client is personally liable to a discharge attorney for the reasonable value of services rendered under a contingent fee agreement when a successor attorney has received the full value of the contingency fee. The second issue is whether the Court of Appeals erred by reversing the trial court's denial of respondent's motion to compel arbitration and vacating the award of fees and costs to the petitioner. The third issue is inextricably intertwined with the second, and it's whether the Court of Appeals erred by failing to address the petitioner's arguments on appeal that the arbitration clause was inapplicable because the contingent fee agreement was unenforceable and avoided the failure to comply with Chapter 23.3 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure. As to the first issue, a client should not be liable for combined attorney's fees greater than the highest contingency fee that she agreed to in any successive contingent fee agreements. This issue is actually very straightforward and can be resolved and should be resolved through the application of one simple principle, and that is clients have an almost absolute right to maintain counsel of their choice. A corollary of that rule is, of course, that anything which infringes upon that right to choose counsel is presumptively invalid as against Colorado public policy. This is because Colorado takes the modern view towards attorney-client fee agreements. In traditional view states, such as Texas and a few others scattered around the United States, attorney-client fee agreements are not viewed any differently than traditional contracts. If a client terminates an attorney, then the traditional contract remedies apply, and that client is on the hook to that attorney under traditional contract law interpretation and on the hook to any subsequent attorneys under the same analysis. On the other hand, in modern view states, like Colorado, we take a different approach. In modern view states, we've cast aside the traditional rules for the position that attorney-client fee agreements are not normal business contracts because of the special fiduciary nature of the attorney-client relationship. Under this view, courts are seen as having the inherent power to regulate the legal profession, and clients are seen as having the inherent right to choose their own counsel. Chapter 23.3 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure governing contingent fee agreements was adopted in 1979 in accordance with these two principles. One of the cases in my research stated in a way that I liked, and they said, caveat emptor is a legal maxim that should not be applicable to attorney-client relationships. Under the modern view, if a client terminates their counsel, they are not breaching their contract. They're simply exercising this inherent right. And that right is a term in all Colorado attorney-client contracts that is implied by public policy. When an attorney is discharged without cause, The attorney does not have traditional contract remedies. Instead, they must pursue recourse under quantum merit principles. Holding, implicitly as it was, as the appellate court did, that a client may be responsible for having to arbitrate and pay a quantum merit fee in addition to a full contingency fee paid to a successor foreign firm would exact an economic penalty on a client for exercising their right to choose their own counsel. It would absolutely chill a client's ability to do so, and therefore would be in direct conflict with Colorado public policy and case law subscribing to the modern view of attorney-client fee agreements. For that simple reason, this court should find that a client cannot be personally responsible to a prior firm after paying the highest ethical contingency fee to which they agreed under any series of contingency fee agreements. Now, this court has already looked favorably upon a decision from another modern view state. In Dudding v. Norm Fricking Associates, this court incorporated language from the Indiana Supreme Court in its decision, Galanis v. Lyons and True. The Galanis Court had in turn adopted the reasoning of the Louisiana Supreme Court's approach to fees for successive lawyers employed under contingent fee agreements. In that case, Saucier v. Hayes Dairy Products, Inc. And what that court said is that only one contingency fee should be paid by the client. The amount of the fee to be determined according to the highest ethical contingency percentage to which the client contractually agreed, and that fee in turn should be allocated between or among the various attorneys involved in handling the claim in question. The Galanis Court and the Indiana Supreme Court adopted that reasoning and held three principles from the Saucier case. First one is that a lawyer retained under a contingent fee contract if discharged prior to the contingency is entitled to recover the value of their services rendered if there is a subsequent settlement and award. Principle two is that the fee is to be measured by the proportion of the total fee equal to the contribution of the discharged lawyer's efforts to the ultimate result. And the third principle is that a subsequent lawyer under a contingent fee agreement who knew of the previous lawyer's representation is responsible for paying the predecessor out of the subsequent lawyer's fee. Petitioners now urge this court to fully adopt the reasoning and conclusions of the Galanis and the Saucier courts for Colorado. Dividing a contingency fee between the attorneys is the most equitable solution and comports with the modern view and the purpose of contingent fee agreements, which is to take the economic burden off the shoulders of litigants who would potentially be otherwise unable to afford access to justice despite the fact that they have valid claims, and put that burden onto the shoulders of attorneys who can then charge what, in comparison to an hourly rate, would be a premium fee for taking that risk.
Counsel, can I just get to focus then? If we agree with you and essentially say that it's between the lawyers and not the client, what happens in this particular case? So is it the $1,000 that you spoke of at the beginning? And are we looking at the amount at all in our consideration today?
No, Your Honor, you're not being asked to look at the amount, and in fact, petitioner's position would be that that's a question of fact as to the amount, and it was determined by the trial court and shouldn't be overturned as an abuse of discretion. That's not an issue before the court today.
Thank you.
So in sort of a reverse way, what you're asking us to do would implicitly indicate that Martinez was not bound in arbitration, and therefore the ruling of the trial court should stand in terms of factual determination. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. This is a matter of first impression about the division of contingency fees. So if the court were to rule that a client's not liable for more than the highest contingency fee, then by necessity, the dispute is between the Stevens law firm and the Martinez law firm, and there's no binding arbitration agreement between those two.
And in terms of the actual outcome of this case, that is, how much the Mintz law firm would be entitled to, that may actually turn out to be the more significant question. Is that right?
Well, Your Honor, that was decided by the trial court. And our position would be that the appellate court's overturning that decision should in turn be overturned, and that that decision should be reinstated, that the Mintz law firm was found to have brought a frivolous and groundless lien, and that they're not entitled to any more than they've actually received.
While we've got you interrupted from your train of thought here, let me just ask you, along the lines that you were arguing, the policy considerations and why we should do one thing or another. In the past, we have encountered related problems, as you allude to, and we've solved those by having rules and having specific requirements for informing a client about the possibility of quantum merit. If all of that is complied with, would finding that the resolution that you suggest we should do now, do you see that as in any way being inconsistent with the rules as we currently have them, and in effect depriving the first counsel of his quantum merit recovery?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I think they're completely consistent with the existing rules, and the reason is quantum merit doesn't guarantee a recovery against the client. Quantum merit is available when someone has come into possession of something of value from another, and it would be unjust for that person to retain possession without paying it in some manner. Quantum merit recovery by Ms. Law Firm in this case can equally be accomplished by the Stevens Law Firm in this case out of the total settlement funds.
And so implicit in what you're saying then is the first attorney would be entitled to his full quantum merit recovery, and it's the second attorney who would have to suffer the loss of that amount out of the full contingent fee. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that normally, although it's a public policy that would affect thousands of Coloradans under contingency fee agreements every year, I think that normally attorneys as professionals are able to work these things out on their own. And if they're not, it should be the attorneys and not the clients who bear the burden of dividing up that fee.
But in this particular case, because of the significance of the arbitration clause, we know that the first attorney would be entitled to very little, if anything, out of the contingent fee. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, if the arbitrator were to find similar to the district court, and that is the way that the district court, Judge Enquist, found.
Well, except if we were to find along the lines you're asking, then we'd find that Martinez was not bound by the arbitration agreement, and therefore the factual ruling of the trial court would stand.
Correct.
So contingent fee agreements generally result in fees that are higher than what's allowed ethically normally under a comparable hourly billable rate. And that's ethical because the attorney is taking the risk to go receive nothing. This means that the contingency fee already incorporates the total value of the quantum merit work for what it's worth, plus an added component for the risk of non-recovery. So to the extent that a prior counsel is entitled to the reasonable value of their services, it's necessarily already a part of the contingency fee paid to the successor firm. Getting back to your earlier question, Justice Coates, formal ethics opinion 100 states that an agreement that provides the discharged and substitute counsel will divide the total attorney's fees between them in proportion to their respective contributions to the case will neither chill the client's exercise of the right to discharge counsel nor result in an unreasonable fee. The Ms. Law Firm has argued in its brief that limiting a client's exposure to one contingency fee would preclude them from quantum merit recovery. However, as we just discussed, that's not the case. They would have a quantum merit recovery. It would just shift who that quantum merit recovery was available from. And actually, that would only be holding that the Ms. Law Firm could, or any prior law firm could recover from a subsequent law firm that held the total contingency fee in trust. Would only be a small extension of the court's holding in Mellett Pressman and Higby LLP versus Hammond Law Firm. And in that case, this court held that an attorney could pursue quantum merit recovery against former co-counsel for their portion of fees, even where they were unable to pursue quantum merit recovery against the client. And this court held that Chapter 23.3 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure did not preclude that quantum merit. The petitioners are requesting that the court determine that the contingent fee clients are not liable for more than one contingency fee on the grounds that it comports with Colorado's modern view regarding attorney-client relationships and protects the client's right to maintain counsel of their own choosing. The second issue regarding arbitration and attorney's fees we also briefly touched upon. And in a nutshell, the main argument is that if there can be only one fee, then there's no arbitration agreement between the Stevens Law Firm and the Mintz Law Firm, and therefore.
And would that be I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off for a minute. So would that be the case then? I mean, I guess it would always, is that right? So that if we were to adopt this rule, it would mean that the client would always be relieved of an arbitration clause in the initial contract. Is that right?
Only to the extent that they had paid the highest contingency fee to which they had agreed under either contingent fee agreement. If it was simply one attorney involved, it wouldn't affect any existing case law.
If they choose to get another attorney and another contingent fee agreement.
Or three attorneys or four attorneys, right. Yes. And under Colorado Ethics Opinion 100, there is some sentences that say that it could potentially be reasonable to have a higher fee where counsel is not discharged through any fault of their own. My interpretation of that statement is that while subsequent counsel could then ethically perhaps charge a 45% contingency fee or 50% contingency fee, depending on the amount of work that was required to be duplicated, not that you could then go above the highest amount that the client had agreed to. So in this situation, the client never agreed to go above 40% under either fee agreement. No notice that that could happen. And that's part of the reason why it should be found invalid. The second issue is in relation to arbitration and attorney's fees. We've covered the first topic, which is that it's between, by necessity, the one fee is between the Stevens Law Offices and the Ince Law Firm. The second reason that the appellate court erred in remanding the matter to the district court to compel arbitration is intertwined with the third issue. And that issue is that the appellate court failed to consider the petitioner's argument that the entire contingency fee was void ab initio for failure to comply with Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure, Chapter 23.3, governing contingency fees.
But counsel, I'm sorry, let me just stop you before you go on to your third argument. So essentially you're arguing, I guess in your first issue, you're saying it's between the attorneys, not the client. And because there was not an arbitration agreement between the attorneys, they weren't going to arbitration. That's kind of your first and second argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then, so I'm trying to figure out what the relation to your third argument. Then, I mean, if we agree with you on the first and second argument, we don't reach the third argument? Are they alternative arguments, I guess?
Yes, they're alternative arguments, Your Honor. I think that the third argument would apply even if the court were to find that a contingency fee client could be responsible under quantum merit for a higher fee than the highest they agreed to under either contingency fee.
Okay. Okay, right. So if we find against you on the first argument, then the third argument still comes into play because you're saying this agreement was void ab initio.
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize for not being clear.
Okay, thank you.
The arbitration clause can't be enforced because the entire contingency fee agreement was unenforceable, and therefore remanding to the district court to compel arbitration was also an error. Contingent fee agreements in Colorado are governed by CRCP Chapter 23.3, Ethics Opinion 100, 116, and a continually growing body of case law. Under Colorado Rule of Professional Conduct 1.5, an attorney's fees must be reasonable, and a contingent fee agreement must also be reasonable under CRCP Chapter 23.3, Rule 3. If it's not, then under Rule 23.3, Rule 6, the entire fee agreement is unenforceable and fails. Under Colorado case law, such as Vera v. Springer and Steinberg, the district courts have the inherent authority to scrutinize contingent fee agreements for their reasonableness, and should do so as a matter of public policy. In other words, the courts, as the governing body of the legal profession, should protect the public from unreasonable contingency fee agreements and attorney overreaching, which should not be tolerated. What's more, the reasonableness of contingency fee agreements by nature cannot be evaluated until after the contingency has occurred in light of all the circumstances and facts of the case. In this case, the district court had the inherent authority and did properly deny the motion to compel arbitration and reviewed the Mintz Law Firm's contingent fee agreement for its reasonableness. The district court heard evidence from an expert endorsed in plaintiff's personal injury law and contingent fee agreements and other witnesses and evidence of trial. They heard that the Mintz Law Firm's contingent fee agreement's conversion clause contained conflicting language that stated that they could recover based on quantum merit and also based on a lodestar recovery. The court heard evidence relative to the level of sophistication of the client, which was not high compared to the law firm. The court heard evidence that Ms. Martinez did not know what criteria would actually be used if the Mintz law firm was terminated without cause and the conversion clause was needed. The court heard that Mr. Gordon testified that Ms. Martinez should not be required to pay more than one fee, that the Mintz law firm's fee purports to take a full compensation based on any settlement offer, which not only infringes on the client's right to terminate counsel, but also infringes on her right to accept or reject the settlement. And that the Mintz law firm was attempting to collect a contingency fee percentage based on an offer that had been rejected before the occurrence of the contingency, which is prima facie unreasonable under the committee codes, chapter 23.3. Ultimately, the district court found that the Mintz law firm was charging $33,333 in change for 10 hours worth of work. Under ethics opinion 100, the conversion clause that results in an unreasonable fee is improper. Trial court determined that the lien amount was frivolous, and at most means was entitled to $1,000, which it may have already collected in the underlying personal injury suit for April Martinez. And again, this finding is the same as determining that the fee was excessive and unreasonable, which the appellate court in Ehrer v. Springer and Steinberg interpreted as meaning that the entire contingent fee agreement is unenforceable. So when a contract is unenforceable and void ad initio, it's against public policy, the arbitration clause does not survive. And although there's some federal law to the contrary, in Colorado, in Gutting versus Norton Freaking Associates at the district court level, that's exactly what Judge Cisneros found, that the entire fee agreement was unreasonable and therefore the arbitration clause was void. It's also supported by a court of appeals decision in RPT of Aspen Inc. for its innovative communications, where the matter was remanded to the district court to determine whether the contract was void against public policy for antitrust grounds. If it was, then the arbitration clause would not survive. Here, since the Ms. Martinez contingent fee agreement was unreasonable, was void ab initio against public policy, and the arbitration clause did not survive, since the arbitration clause did not survive, the district court properly exercised jurisdiction over the fee dispute where the charging lien had been filed and not underlying matter. Lastly, amicus curiae Colorado Trial Lawyers Association more fully briefed the issue in their amicus brief, but petitioners agree with their position that arbitration is no longer an option for the Mintz law firm when they chose to utilize the charging lien under CRS 12-5-119. And again, this is an alternative argument if the court rules against petitioners in the first argument. When the Mintz law firm filed that lien, providing notice that they had a lien on any judgment or settlement funds that lien was enforceable against all third parties, including the Stevens Law Offices. However, further action is still required to enforce that. Under the statute, the lien can be enforced in a proper civil action, and that can either be in an independent action or it can be in the same action that gave rise to the lien. The Stevens Law Offices appropriately challenged the lien in the civil action that gave rise to the lien pursuant to G versus Crabtree. And the district court properly exercised jurisdiction over the dispute, and it was an error to remand and compel arbitration. And finally, the appellate court also erred by vacating the district court's award of attorney's fees and costs. Mintz's lien was found to be excessive and unreasonable, and if this court agrees that the matter should not have been arbitrated, then that finding should only be disturbed if there was an abuse of discretion. Therefore, petitioners respectfully request that the award of attorney's fees and costs be reinstated. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve my final 2 minutes or so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Certainly. Mr. Scully?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Respondents don't necessarily have a stark disagreement with the petitioners in regard to this overarching issue that a client, the vast majority of the time, should probably be liable for one, what is typically associated with as one percentage of the gross recovery that we see in a typical contingent fee agreement, whether it's 30%, 35, 40, or somewhere below or above that. We don't necessarily disagree with that. What we disagree with the petitioners on is the procedure by which that fee is determined. And obviously, we're talking about that determination in the context where client hires one attorney, discharges an attorney, hires second or third, however many other attorneys, and then obtains the resolution by obtaining property or money through his or her claim of a lawsuit. And the way the petitioners would have it is that the final attorney in the string of successive attorneys be paid, you know, if indeed that last attorney is paid the full fee under that last contingent fee agreement, then all of the predecessor lawyers' fee claims then flow to that last attorney, and client is essentially out of outside of that privity or outside of that claim or whatever we would call it. Now, is that the worst idea in the world? I'm not really sure. But the fact of the matter is that Colorado law does not provide for that right now. I'm going to explain here in a minute how the statutes, the rules of professional conduct, and how the formal ethics opinions in Colorado all work together for the processing of attorneys' claims in this circumstance where there are successive lawyers. It's respondents' position that law as it stands works perfectly well and does not need to be disturbed. And in the context of all that law, I will answer the specific questions that are on appeal now. And as a preparatory, I know we've used phrases like discharge lawyer, successive lawyer, predecessor, successor, things like that. I'm just going to refer to them as attorney one and attorney two for the sake of simplicity. And again, I'm going to just talk about the general framework of CRS 12-5-119 and how it works in conjunction with the other laws in order to determine proper fee amounts in this context. First of all, CRS section 12-5-119 provides that an attorney who provides services to a client automatically has lien rights against the client. Now, 12-5-119 also provides separately that the lawyer who's provided these services may file in the district court, if indeed there is a lawsuit on file, may file a notice of lien. Now, the notice of lien is required to contain information with respect to the compensation agreement between lawyer who filed the notice of lien and client. And the effect of the notice of lien is that it provides notice to all interested parties of the client, attorney one's lien claim. And with respect to procedure, it also then allows the lawyer to enforce a subsequent judgment against any third party who has settlement funds or other funds that were recovered and that are subject to that lien. So, again, attorney one has a right to be paid and has a fee claim. There's no question about that in any of Colorado law. There's a long line of cases dealing with that. I don't think that that's in question. The difficult issue is how the amount and the value of attorney one's fee is determined. By and large, the case law and rules that have been approved by the Supreme Court, Chapter 23.3 and others, dictate that attorney one has a quantum merit claim against the client if and when the client recovers money or property through the subsequent lawyer. Quantum merit, as Mr. Eisenstein said, I think means amount owed. Obviously, it's an equitable claim, which is based on the facts and circumstances that are presented. And so, in essence, it's a case-by-case determination. Now, the Ethics Committee, in its opinion number 100, has weighed in on the concept of there being specific fee calculation equations in fee agreements, like the Lodestar equation and others, in this context. And the Ethics Committee has said that they're not necessarily void on their face, but they're probably subject to strict scrutiny when coming from attorney one. So those are not automatically void or somehow unlawful, but by and large, attorney one's claim against the client after settlement sounds in quantum merit. Now, attorney one's claim against the client after the recovery is also governed by Rule of Professional Conduct 1.5, which generally requires that anything that any lawyer takes, whether it's contingent, hourly, whatever it is, has to be reasonable. Unreasonable fees are unlawful. And it addresses this in general, but it also addresses it under 1.5 subsection D3 in the context of multiple attorneys. When there's more than one attorney who's going to be paid a fee for one set of services that have been provided to the client. And Rule 1.5 says that total fee must be reasonable. So in this context, the fee payable in accordance with the attorney one's quantum error claim and attorney two's fee that he or she would collect under his fee agreement or otherwise, the combination of those has to be reasonable also. So that addresses attorney one's fee claim and right and how he can make his claim, or at least how it sounds. Now, we also have to think about attorney two in this situation, because as we've said, attorney two's fee in combination with attorney one's fee in total must be reasonable. The Ethics Committee has also weighed in on attorney two's obligations in this circumstance where client discharges attorney one and then goes to attorney two. And in Ethics Opinion 100, the committee has explained that attorney two has obligations at the outset of that relationship and has obligations at the time of settlement. Now, at the outset of the relationship, the Ethics Committee states that attorney two has the obligation to inquire of the client with respect to the fee agreement between client and attorney number one. And it says that attorney two should do that because he needs to ensure that the total fee that's going to be payable to attorney two and to attorney one is reasonable in total. The Ethics Committee further states that at the outset of the representation, attorney two has to inform the client about these issues and about the fact that attorney one is going to have a fee claim and attorney two is going to be paid also. So, in essence, the second attorney, this makes perfect sense, has to inform the client of everything that he or she is facing with respect to fees.
Mr. Scully, can I interrupt you?
Yes.
So if you're in agreement that the client should only pay one fee, and attorney two has all of these obligations, why is this fight not between the two attorneys? Is that where you're going?
That's where I'm going.
Then how does arbitration apply to a non-party? Okay.
I mean, I understand that my understanding of arbitration law under the Arbitration Act is that someone can only be compelled to arbitration if they're.
So are you in agreement that we should reverse the Court of Appeals? Because they ordered this to go to arbitration.
I believe the Court of Appeals ordered that the claim between Mintz and Martinez be compelled to arbitration.
But you're in agreement, right? I understand. But you're saying that this isn't a fight between Mintz and Martinez. This is a fight between Mintz and Stevens.
No, I'm saying this is a fight between Mintz and Martinez.
Okay.
Which I'll get to in just a second.
Okay.
All right. So attorney two has obligations at the outset.
Well, why don't you just get to that? Because that's what we're.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. We'll do it. The attorney two, at the time of settlement, has obligations under Rule 1.15 to segregate any funds that are in dispute. So, where attorney one is discharged, hires attorney two, and attorney two then settles the case, or case judgment at the trial. Attorney two is aware of attorney one's lien claim. So, attorney two is aware that the funds he's recovered, at least part of them, are in dispute because attorney one has interest in them. Under Rule 1.15, it's absolutely clear that attorney two, in that circumstance, has to segregate the funds, basically put them in his trust account. Now, at this point, and this is exactly where we were in the underlying case, so this is why this is very important. Because there, Stevens had obtained settlement, Mintz had filed its notice of lien, and Mintz then intended to enforce its lien and seek a judgment that it could enforce. At this point, when there's a notice of lien on file and there are settlement funds that are held in trust because attorney two has knowledge that they're in dispute, the question that we have is, what claim does lawyer one have? What right of action does lawyer one have to enforce that notice of lien against the funds? Now, it's very clear in 12-5-119, the last sentence of it says, such lien may be enforced by proper civil action. So what is that civil action? That civil action under Colorado law is and it can be within the case in chief, or it can be filed in an independent action, and we argue an arbitration, and that's also noted in some of the comments to Rule 1.15. It's our position that the proper civil action is a right of action between lawyer and client. Files a motion within the underlying case to reduce his lien to judgment, or he files an independent action to do that. There are myriad Colorado cases that address the issue of the effect of a lien and what the lawyer who filed the lien can do with it. It says the lawyer, the lien, when it is filed, it attaches to funds, it's chargeable. That lien can then be enforced if the lawyer who filed it obtains a judgment. Which makes perfect sense.
But you're talking about a judgment against a client.
It's a judgment against the client. It's a judgment against the client, but it's enforceable under the lien. So it's enforceable against a party who holds the rights, the property that's subject to the lien, who does not then observe the judgment. But and it makes perfect sense because if lawyer one files a lien, again, according to the statute, you just have to put the information with respect to the compensation agreement as a percentage amount, doesn't require a dollar amount. That's just notice to the world, hey, I've got a lien for you. And so if that was enforceable as a judgment, lawyer could put any number he wants in it and then go after any party that holds the risk, which, whether it's attorney two, whether it's insurance company who has refused to pay the funds out because they're liens against it or whatever. So lawyer has to file that proper civil action to obtain a judgment. And if client has a problem with that, client will defend it, and that claim is resolved under lawyer one's quantum merit rights. And again, whichever tribunal is handling it, whether it's a district court, whether it's an arbitrator, looks at all facts and circumstances. So, with respect to how this works in the general context, as we talk about, the point where we're at is where attorney two is holding funds because he's resolved the case. Attorney one has filed his notice of lien. Then attorney one files either a motion or a separate action to reduce his rights to judgment. When that judgment is, when he gets that judgment, then lawyer two, who's been holding the funds, just pays them to lawyer one. Now again, harkening back,
And lawyer two is left with whatever was left over under the contingency.
Correct, which is what makes it difficult. And that's what makes it difficult when lawyer two takes on a client who is discharged attorney one, as the ethics committee has explained in opinion 100, lawyer two has to think about that and has to explain to the client, hey, that lawyer number one has the right to pay because he did a bunch of work for him. And I have the right to pay too. So this is all going to come out in the wash somehow.
Well, counsel, maybe I can just stop you there then. I guess your contention then is the proper vehicle to reduce this lien is an action against the client.
That is the core issue, yes.
Right. And why is that? Why is it not an action against the attorney who's holding the funds?
Because
you get to the same place, I guess, is where you just said. The attorney holding the funds must turn the funds over to anyone.
Correct. Well, there are a number of reasons. One, and most importantly, that a right of action against someone other than the client under the sentence such lien may be enforced by proper civil action, there's no suggestion anywhere that right of action lies against anyone but the client. There's just no support. So if we would determine that now, that's brand new law. And is that the way to go? We don't necessarily think so, because other issues that arise from that are the arbitrability, as we talked about with Mr. Eisenstein. There's not a contract between lawyer one and lawyer two. So everyone of these disputes will have to be resolved in court. There are arbitration provisions in a lot of communities. It could also result in lawyer number one having to sue an insurance company. If insurance companies holding the funds. So we believe that the system as it is set is the best way to resolve these issues.
Maybe I can push you a little harder then. How do we know that the action against the client is the proper civil action? You're kind of assuming that's
because
how it works, but maybe you can explain to me why that is.
Because it's very clear that lawyer one's claim sounds in quantum merit. Quantum merit is a quasi-contractual claim that's based on services provided between one person and another person or entity or whatever that may be. Where those services are provided, that is where the benefit runs. So it makes the most sense for the claim to flow within privity of those two parties. Otherwise, as I said, you could have lawyer one suing Allstate based on VentureHub to reduce its lien to judgment. And then Allstate's defending the claim, saying, we're defending this claim because you did work, and what's the value of your work? That would not be tenable.
Well, it wouldn't be tenable under contract, but it would be tenable under quantum merit, because they'd be saying, we did all the work, and this lawyer made the contingency fee, right? That's why they talk about these being in quantum merit.
I don't totally disagree that there could be an unjust enrichment claim against lawyer two.
Well, that would be the only claim. He doesn't have a contract with attorney.
That's correct.
One. So.
And there are policies, I assume, regarding contingent fee. And clients not be whipsawed and only have to pay one fee that are at stake here. So when the funds are there, the dispute is really over the funds. Who gets that? Wouldn't it be much better for client protection purposes to go at it that way? Right? We have caution over contingent fees.
It's
other use, and you're requiring a suit against the client when the client can say, here's the 40%. I'm free. I don't need to be sued.
I mean, that's true to a certain degree.
Well, it seems to me you're trying to wedge arbitration into this to get away from the fact that the rules would favor one payment and the client is free. Takes home her judgment. The family gets it if she's not around anymore. Why don't the ethical rules, the contingency fee, the authorization for them, the protection of clients, indicate that this is not the preferred way to go, an independent lawsuit against the client?
Your Honor, there is just simply no precedent whatsoever.
Well, let's make it.
For
you know, the combination of what a civil action is, putting the money in effect in the trust, the stake, that's what the fight is over. Avoiding needless litigation against clients, letting them go about their life and their business. The two attorneys are the ones that should determine in front of the proper judge, I assume, in a civil action, who gets what out of that pot. Why isn't that the simple, most straightforward way to resolve this? What's wrong with it?
Well, again, the services and the value run from attorney one.
But a judge gets to decide that.
That's true. And I suppose the point is, if lawyer one files a motion to reduce his lien to judgment in the underlying case, the judge is going to make a determination there too.
But the other lawyer ought to be involved, right? The other lawyers presumably brought home the bacon, right? Got the settlement.
That's correct.
Got the judgment.
That's correct.
So I think you're trying to cut out the other lawyer here through and having an independent action. There's going to be another lawsuit.
Well,
that's what it sounds like to me.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, I think our analysis derives from Colorado law up to this point. And if this court feels that it should fashion a new cause of action between attorney number one and attorney number two.
There's a precedent in our cases already.
I'm not aware of that.
You know, I think it's in the briefs, I mean.
I would just be...
1 fee. Or the two attorneys that are the ones that determine what should be paid to which. There was a replacement law firm.
On that issue, the Ethics Committee, in Opinion 100, has weighed in on that also and said that there are times when a client should reasonably pay more than what is one percentage. And some other, and that can happen under a myriad of circumstances, most of which probably involve a client who causes more work than otherwise would have to be done, and the lawyer shouldn't necessarily be punished for that. Because understand, lawyer two is punished also if the money the lawyer wants coming out of the one net funds. And other issues there are that it could be subject to abuse because attorney two could fashion his fee agreement such that there's a low percentage, and then when lawyer one brings his action against lawyer two, the tribunal could say, well, the client's already paid the full fee, there's only 25% there. So that wouldn't do well by either attorney, quite frankly. And again, our argument derives from the current status of Colorado law, and we do not believe that there has been any cause of action that has been approved by any appellate court that runs between lawyer number one and lawyer number two in this circumstance.
Let me ask you another question then. If that's the case, doesn't lawyer number two have to be a party to that at the very least? And I'm just an old trial judge, so let me give you the practical implication of that. The attorney one obtains a judgment of $25,000 to be received from those fees from the client. And the client says, I don't have the fees. They're in the attorney's trust account, as you acknowledged. Does the judge hold the client in contempt? I mean, how does that become enforceable?
Because those fees are being held by attorney number two in his trust account. Because
they're party to the lawsuit, the way you're describing.
Well, he's not party to the lawsuit, but that's when the lien right and the fee right becomes enforceable. And that's what the statute provides for. That once it's reduced to judgment, it's enforceable.
But enforceable against who?
Enforceable against whoever's holding funds.
But they're not a party to the case.
So not the client at that point? It's essentially against the race,
and so whoever is holding the risk, it could be lawyer two, it could be an insurance company.
Let me follow up with my old judge quandary. So then I ordered the attorney to pay the whatever was received in the judgment to attorney one. I ordered attorney two to pay to attorney one then, as the trial judge in that?
I don't necessarily know that there's an order that unless there's evidence on the record as to the money being held in his trust, I think.
Okay, I'm assuming that we've all agreed that the money should be held in attorney two's trust account. So we're ordering them to pay, but they're not a party to the case. That's what I'm saying.
They're only the race that's the subject of the order. That's in rem action.
I still have to, as a trial judge, I still have to have jurisdiction over them.
You have jurisdiction, the trial judge has jurisdiction over the race. I think it's akin to an in rem action that's against a piece of property, quiet title, or something like that.
I'm going to suggest that the LaFon case, although it's not exactly on, provides the framework. Basically, you have two attorneys scrapping over the contingency fee. Right?
Right?
So I think we have precedent about how to handle it. So why shouldn't we just extend that?
Were working together in the same firm, I believe, in the LaFon case.
They were operating as separate attorneys, you know.
At the time of the action, I think you're right.
Correct.
You're right.
Right. And the second attorney had the money, right? You got the recovery, the judgment. The first attorney wanted a piece of it, right?
That's pretty correct. I believe that they
just decided that case.
I agree. One comment I would have about the superiority of the current law on this is that lawyer one's claim sounds in quantum merit, which is what is fair. So, all of the facts are taken into consideration. The client will not be subject to abuse because the tribunal over the quantum merit action will have information about the work done by both lawyers, what was paid to second lawyer. The second lawyer actually took funds out of his trust account, which he shouldn't have done. And we think that that is the superior mechanism that is most fair. Otherwise, we think that there is much potential for abuse, because when client fires lawyer one and then goes to lawyer two then, in essence, controls the whole fee. What's what he's going to receive, and then what lawyer one is going to receive. If we're talking about the total fee being limited to that one contingent amount, it's just untenable. It's going to be subject to abuse. And again, it's either second lawyer determining the total amount of the fee based on an arbitrary percentage that he puts in his fee agreement, or it's a judge or an arbitrator in a quantum merit action that lawyer brings, who can make the best decision and who will have all the information in front of him or her to fashion the most equitable decision. And we think that that is the superior way to go. And I'll reserve my last 43 seconds for questions.
If there are questions, you can answer them. If you're finished, you can go ahead and sit down, but you don't have any time to reserve. In other words, you're finished once you're finished.
I understand. I'm finished.
You're finished.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Scott. Mr. Eisenstein.
Could I ask you a question or two? Since maybe we can just pick up right where we left off with your opposing counsel, only turn it around the other way. Let's assume your position with regard to policy, and that the client should only have to be responsible for one contingent fee. I believe during your earlier part of your argument, you agreed, though, it wasn't a question of deciding how much one should get, one attorney or the other, aside from the fact that we will simply calculate what the quantum merit benefit for the first attorney was, and that should be subtracted from the amount of the contingent fee. So we really don't have an interpleader in the sense that you all are not debating about who gets what portion of the fee The question is simply, how much was the first attorney entitled to in quantum merit, and that gets subtracted from the amount, if I understand that right. Given that situation, unless you disagree with me on that, why should the client be relieved of her contract to submit to arbitration with regard to cause for breaking the first agreement and the quantum merit?
Let me start with the question of whether I agree with that or not. I'm not sure I do. I think that's effectively what happened in this case, but it's all because there wasn't really any evidence or witnesses or much cross-examination at the trial court level. I think that the appropriate vehicle to determine the relative contributions of both attorney one and attorney two should occur at that level in front of a district court judge, and the district court judge should make a determination of what fees are assigned to what counsel based on.
Could I just stop you there, because you said the relative contributions, but that I thought you answered my question earlier about why this didn't violate our current rule allowing a quantum merit to an attorney whose contingent fee is broken without cause. I thought you were saying, so we don't have to determine the relative contributions of the two, we only have to determine what the contribution of the first attorney was, and that automatically gets subtracted from the amount of the contingent fee.
I'm not sure it's two distinct things, Your Honor, I guess in my mind. Maybe I'm just not seeing it correctly, but to me, there's one recovery, and whatever is assigned to attorney one necessarily comes out of the funds that attorney two is holding in trust. So I don't know.
But attorney one gets his amount based on what he did, not on his relative contribution to the outcome compared with attorney two, right?
No, that would not be my position. I would urge the court to adopt the Galanis holding, which asks the courts to look at the relative contributions of both attorneys to fashion a fair remedy from the one fee.
Okay.
Can I ask you, Chief, can I ask one?
Sure.
You used the phrase, the highest contingency fee applicable. So if we have a situation where attorney one had a 33% contingency fee, and then shortly before trial or whatever, maybe another attorney comes in and says, I'm only going to charge you 15% of what we recover, so that they're getting a lower contingency fee to prevent the attorney from the client from switching over. In that case, there would still be a cause of action against the client, correct?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. I think in theory, yes, as a practicing plaintiff's attorney, I don't know that that would happen very often.
Well, if somebody sees it set up and ready to go. Maybe I'm too hypothetical.
I guess, yes, I guess you're right. That could potentially happen, but I think that once, it's my position that you can't recover a contingency fee once you've been discharged prior to the occurrence of the contingency. It's my position that's not even ethical. So in theory, yes, that could happen. However, I think your only recourse once the contract is terminated, again, that's just exercising your inherent right as a client to terminate that contract. I think your only recovery is quantum merit. I think that's pretty well established. So I guess my answer to that would be, I don't think that's allowable, but if it was, then yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, it seems like we are finished. So thank you, Mr. Eisenstein.
Thank you.
And you as well, Mr. Scully. The court is going to take a little break to allow the courtroom to get resituated. Probably about 15 minutes. We're in recess.